Welcome to the Beer Storian, brought to you by beergasmic.com, where we dig into the fascinating fermented stories behind the world's favorite drink. In today's episode, we're unpacking the story of the India Pale Ale, a style that's come to define modern craft beer, but whose roots stretch back centuries.
From the shipping routes of the British Empire to the tap lists of your local brewery, the IPA has traveled a long, hoppy road. We'll explore how it was born out of necessity, shaped by empire, nearly forgotten, and then reinvented by a new generation of brewers.
So grab a pint, get comfortable, and let's take a deeper look at the history behind the beer that changed the world of hops forever.
Yes. IPA. It's got such a fascinating history, hasn't it? It really covers like centuries and continents, global trade, brewing breakthroughs, and, well, a pretty dramatic comeback story, too.
Exactly. And it's definitely not just, you know, one guy having a light bulb moment. Okay, so let's start at the beginning, or maybe the evolution before the beginning. It seems IPA grew out of existing pale ales in Britain.
That's absolutely right. Forget the idea of a single invention. IPA really emerged gradually from pale ale brewing in Britain. Maybe 18th, early 19th century, brewers were already making these pale ales.
Paler because of the fuel they used for the kilns, yeah? Coke instead of wood.
Exactly. Coke burns cleaner, less smoke, so you get paler malt. And crucially, brewers knew back then that adding more hops helped preserve beer, especially if it was going somewhere warm. So many pale ales, particularly for export, were already pretty hoppy.
Right. Those preservative oils in the hops. And wasn't there this thing called October beer? Does that fit in?
And it really does. October beer was this strong, pale, well-hopped ale brewed in the autumn, meant to be aged, sometimes for a good year or two. And the interesting thing, when they shipped beers like this to India, the voyage itself...
The rocking and the heat?
Yeah, the motion, the temperature rate, actually accelerated the maturation, made the beer ready to drink, and apparently quite pleasant when it arrived.
So shipping beer all the way to India wasn't some crazy new idea when IPA came along.
Not at all. By the late 1700s, sending beer to India, both dark porters and pale ales, was pretty standard practice. They knew beer could handle the trip, even year-long voyages. So this popular story that they had to invent a super-strong, hyper-hopped beer just to survive the journey, it's a bit of a myth. We've got records of British beer arriving safely in India as early as 1711.
Wow, that early?
Yep. And by the 1760s, brewing guides were already saying, you know, add extra hops for beers going to hot climates. It was understood.
Okay, but George Hodgson, bar brewery, he always comes up. What's his actual role then? If he didn't invent it.
Hodgson's definitely important, but not as the sole inventor. His significance really came down to, well, a couple of key things. First, location. His brewery was right by the East India docks in London. Super convenient for ships heading out.
Logistics,
yeah. And second, his business practices. He offered really generous credit terms to the ship captains, like 12, even 18 months to pay.
Ah, that would make him popular.
Absolutely. If you're a captain looking to load up on goods to sell in India, including beer, Hodgson was your guy. Easy access, easy credit.
Makes sense. And his beer did become popular over there?
Oh, definitely. By the early 1800s, Hodgson's pale ale, they often just called it beer or pale ale in India, was a favorite among the British officials and merchants, especially in Bengal and Madras. And there's this great Calcutta newspaper ad from 1822.
What did it say?
It praised Hodgson's prime-picked pale ale of the genuine October brewing, see? Directly linking it back to that tradition of strong-aged, well-hopped pale ales.
Got it. So Hodgson gets the credit for really making a success of exporting this style using existing techniques.
Yeah.
But his business smarts were maybe just as important as the beer recipe itself.
I think that's a fair way to put it. He capitalized on existing practices and his location, and then out of all this, the name starts to stick. Around 1829, you start seeing India Pale Ale or East India Pale Ale appearing in print. That's when it gets formalized.
Okay. So a gradual evolution driven by trade and circumstance. Now let's talk about that colonial era connection more and the East India Company's role.
Right, the EIC. Its story is completely tangled up with the rise of IPA. They weren't, like, commissioning a specific beer style, but they created the whole framework. The demand was there. Their own people, officers, merchants in India wanted beer from home.
Yeah, and Hudson initially filled that niche really well.
He did. Location and how he issued credit, he had the early advantage. Even if his pale ale wasn't radically different at first, his stuff, pale ale and porter, was apparently everywhere among the British in India by about 1800. And people noticed, like we said, that his stronger October-style pale ale arrived in great shape. That really cemented the idea. Drier? More hops? That's the way to go for India. It is that description from 1843 saying, India-bound pale ale was carefully fermented so as to be devoid of all sweetness. And it contains double the usual quantity of hops. A clear shift.
They were definitely tweaking it for the market.
For sure. By the 1820s, ads mentioned pale ale prepared for the India market, so conscious adjustments were happening.
But then Hodgson, or rather his son running the brewery, made a bit of a mistake.
A pretty big one, business-wise. Around 1821, they decided to change tactics. They cut off the long credit lines, hiked prices, and tried to ship directly to India themselves, cutting out the middleman ship captains.
Ooh, that wouldn't have gone down well.
It really didn't. It angered the captains and merchants, the very people who'd made Hodgson's beer popular, and that created an opportunity.
For someone else.
Exactly. An EIC director, Campbell Margie Banks, connected to the shipping guys, basically went to Samuel Alsop, a brewer in a town called Burton-on-Trent in early 1822, and said, "Can you make something like Hodgson's, but, you know, for us?"
Enter Burton-on-Trent. And this is where the water comes in, right?
This is crucial. Burton's water is famous among brewers. It's naturally very high in calcium sulfate gypsum, basically, sometimes called Burton salts.
And that's good for pale ales.
It's fantastic for pale ales. That high sulfate level accentuates hot bitterness, makes it seem crisper, drier, cleaner. It helps the hops really shine. London water, where Hodgson brewed, had a different mineral makeup better suited for darker beers like porter.
Wow. Water chemistry. So Alsop had a natural advantage.
A huge one. His first shipments in 1823 were a massive hit. People in India apparently preferred it to Hodgson's almost immediately.
Really? That quick?
Within about a year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And other Burton brewers, Bass, Salt, jumped right in too by 1823. By the 1830s, Burton breweries, especially Bass and Alsop, totally dominated the India beer trade. Hodgson lost a lot of ground.
So a bad business move by Hodgson and the magic water of Burton changed the game. Now, that idea about British troops only drinking IPA in India, how true is that?
Yeah, that's often exaggerated. Porter was still popular in India throughout the 19th century. It wasn't like everyone suddenly switched to pale ale just because it was hot. People drank what they could get, including dark beers. And it's really important to remember who was drinking it. This was largely beer for the British colonials, imported for them. It wasn't typically something indigenous Indians drank, partly because they were often barred from the places serving it.
That's a critical social context. So when did IPA become a big deal back in England itself?
It started gaining popularity back home from the 1840s onwards. People returning from India brought the taste and the name back with them. Brewers started marketing it. It got this kind of, you know, exotic imperial cachet and became fashionable, very much so by the mid-19th century. Bass Pale Ale, with that iconic red triangle logo, the first registered trademark in the UK, actually became a huge global brand. So IPA went from being just a practical export beer to a real symbol of British brewing and commerce. Still fundamentally British, though, not really Indian in identity.
Fascinating arc. But then, after that peak, things started to go downhill for IPA. What caused the decline?
Yeah, it really fell off quite dramatically. A few things came together. One big factor was technology, refrigeration, and alongside that, the rise of pale lagers.
Ah, lagers. Crisp, refreshing.
Exactly. By the 1880s, 1890s, they could brew lagers locally in India using refrigeration and in a hot climate. A cold, crisp lager. No, it's appealing. It started to compete seriously with imported ales.
Makes sense. Any other reasons?
Oh yeah. Tastes were changing back in Britain too, in Victorian times. You had the temperance movement gaining steam, pushing back against stronger drinks.
Right.
Brewers started making milder beers. Tax laws also started to hit higher alcohol beers harder, and you had more people working in offices maybe wanting something lighter during the day.
So the actual beer being called IPA changed. It got weaker.
Drastically. By the early 20th century, if you bought something labeled India Pale Ale in England, it was often pretty tame, maybe under 4% ABV, not very hoppy at all. It became more of a marketing label for a standard pale ale, or bitter, honestly.
Lost its original character.
Totally. And the export market to India dried up local brewing, different drink preferences like spirits or tea, taking over among the colonials. Then the final nail in the coffin, especially in the US, was prohibition.
Right, 1920s.
Wiped out most breweries. And when brewing came back after 1933, the focus was almost entirely on light adjunct lagers. Proper IPA basically vanished from the American scene. It was really on the brink of extinction.
Wow. From global symbol to almost forgotten. So how on earth did it come back so strongly? It's huge now.
It's an amazing comeback story. It really is. It started stirring in the late 20th century. But the real explosion came with the craft beer movement picking up speed in the 80s and 90s.
What kicked it off?
A couple things. In the UK, you had CAMRA, the Campaign for Real Ale, starting in the 70s. They got people interested in traditional British ale styles again. There were a few surviving examples, like Worthington's White Shield, a bottle-conditioned IPA that kept a link to the past. Bottle-conditioned, by the way, just means it carbonates naturally in the bottle, adds complexity.
Okay, so a flicker of interest in the UK.
Right.
But the main engine was the US.
Definitely. American craft brewers were the driving force. They were actively looking for flavorful alternatives to the mass market lagers that dominated. They started digging into history.
And found inspiration in IPA.
They did. One beer that sort of survived, though it changed over time, was Ballantine IPA. For a while, it was still relatively hoppy, maybe 7% ABV aged in oak. It wasn't quite the original. But it gave early craft brewers like, you know, Fritz Maytag and Anchor Brewing a hint of what a bolder ale could be.
And Anchor's Liberty Ale in 75. Yeah, that
hugely
was key,
important.
Wasn't it?
They didn't call it an IPA, but it was absolutely inspired by the idea, and crucially, they dry hopped it with Cascade hops.
Cascade. That's the American hop with the grapefruit notes.
That's the one. Dry hopping means adding hops late in the process, mainly for aroma. Liberty Ale had this bright, citrusy aroma that was revolutionary at the time. It's widely seen as the spiritual ancestor of modern American IPA.
And then the West Coast brewers took that idea and ran with it.
Oh, absolutely. Early 80s, guys like Burt Grant up in Yakima, Washington, a hop country, they just leaned into those local American hops. Cascade, Chinook with its piney notes. They started making IPAs that were way more aromatic, way more bitter, really showcasing those citrus and pine flavors.
Pushing the boundaries.
Totally. By the 1990s, this bold, hop-forward West Coast style was American craft beer's flagship. It defined the movement, and that intense hoppiness eventually circled back and influenced brewers in the UK and elsewhere too. These American brewers basically said, okay, that strong hoppy beer from history, we're bringing it back, maybe even dialing it up.
And did people in the UK object to American hops being used?
There was some debate, yeah, about authenticity, but historians pointed out that British brewers actually imported American hops back in the 19th century when they needed them, so there was precedent.
Huh. Okay, so by the 2000s, IPA was back bigger than ever.
Absolutely dominant. It was the craft beer style globally. Almost every craft brewery had to have one. Drinkers developed a real taste for hops, and that led to even more experimentation. Imperial or double IPAs. Even stronger, even hoppier. And then the explosion of new hop varieties, Citra, Mosaic, Galaxy, giving brewers this incredible palette of flavors. By 2010, IPA wasn't just back, it was the undisputed king of craft beer.
Incredible turnaround, and it hasn't stopped evolving, has it? In this modern craft era, we've seen IPA splinter into all these different substyles.
That's right. The core idea, hop forward pale ale, is still there. But the variations now are just immense. You've got that classic West Coast IPA, the template for American IPA, you know, known for bitterness, dryness, pine, citrus, floral notes from those sea hops, Cascade, Centennial, Chinook, Columbus. Think Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, though maybe a bit lighter. Anchor Liberty Ale, Stone, Lagunitas, they really define that.
Uh-huh. But then came the haze craze, New England IPA.
Yeah. New England IPA, Hazy IPA, Juicy IPA, whatever you call it, popped up in the 2010s and really turned things on their heads. All about massive hop aroma, often tropical fruit, passion fruit, mango kind of smells, plus a really soft, smooth, almost creamy mouthfeel, and that characteristic haze or cloudiness.
And much less bitter than West Coast style, typically.
Way less perceived bitterness, yeah. They achieve it with different techniques. Huge amounts of dry hops added late. Specific yeast strains that throw off fruity flavors, often leaving the beer unfiltered. And sometimes adding things like oats or wheat for body.
Who were the pioneers there?
Breweries like The Alchemist with Hetty Topper are legendary. Trillium, Treehouse, they really put that style on the map. It got so popular, the Brewers Association had to create a whole new category for it. Juicy or Hazy IPA. It's funny. Compared to that old description of IPA being devoid of all sweetness, non-IPAs are often perceived as much less dry, much more lush.
And what about brewed IPA? That seemed like a flash in the pan.
It was interesting. Popped up around 2018, the idea was to make an IPA that was super, super dry, like brut champagne. They used an enzyme to break down pretty much all the sugars. So you got hop aroma, but almost zero sweetness, very high carbonation, pale color, very effervescent.
But it didn't stick around like Hazy.
Not really, no. It had its moment, but didn't capture drinkers' imaginations in the same way. But it shows the experimentation, right? And you've got loads of others. Double or Imperial IPAs. Session IPAs, which are lower alcohol but still hoppy. Black IPAs or Cascadian Dark Ales. Belgian IPAs using Belgian yeast. White IPAs with wheat and spices. Sour IPAs.
It's amazing how flexible the category is.
It really is. The common thread is just that focus on hop character, aroma, or flavor in a pale beer base. And brewers keep getting new hops to play with from the US, Australia, New Zealand, Germany. It makes IPA this constant platform for hop innovation. Today's IPA is really a diverse family, a true chameleon. Some using hops those Victorian brewers couldn't have dreamed of.
So, given all this history and evolution, what's the impact IPA has had culturally and economically, especially in this craft beer era?
Oh, the impact is huge. You really can't overstate it. IPA is without doubt the flagship style of 21st century craft beer. For so many craft breweries, their IPA isn't just a beer, it's the beer that pays the bills. It's the bedrock.
Culturally, why did it become so central? Was it just about the flavor?
I think the flavor was key, especially initially. Like we said, it was the hops. That bold bitterness and aroma were such a clear contrast to the mass market lagers people were used to. Hops became the symbol of craft beer's rejection of blandness, and IPA was the perfect vehicle for showcasing that.
A statement beer.
Exactly. If you were starting a craft brewery, putting out a great IPA showed you were serious about flavor, and consumers responded. Look at the sales data. IPA has been the top-selling craft style in the U.S. and many other places for years now. It makes up a massive chunk of craft beer sales.
So bars and shops have to stock good IPAs.
Pretty much, yeah. If you want to attract craft beer drinkers, you need a solid IPA selection. It's almost an expectation. The label IPA itself has become a powerful selling point.
And economically, it's not just small brewers. Big companies noticed, too.
For sure. The success of IPA-focused craft breweries definitely attracted attention, leading to some high-profile acquisitions by larger beer corporations wanting a piece of that profitable market.
And what about the drinkers? You mentioned hopheads. Yeah. Is there a whole subculture around IPA?
There absolutely is. The term hophead describes people who just love intensely hoppy beers. You see this passion online in forums, trading groups, people queuing for special IPA releases from certain breweries known for them, like Hetty Topper back in the day. For many enthusiasts, developing an appreciation for IPA, especially the bitter ones, became almost like a badge of honor. It shaped modern beer geek identity. People compare enjoying the bitterness to liking strong coffee or spicy food. It's a complex flavor profile you learn to appreciate.
Even the jokes about everyone only drinking IPA show how central it is.
Exactly. The fact that people joke about IPA dominance or the IBU wars, International Bitterness Units, just highlights its cultural weight. Economically, it's the engine for countless craft breweries. It helped fuel the UK craft scene's revival too, and it's often a gateway style in new craft markets globally. Plus, think about the spin-off effect on hop farming. The demand for specific aromatic hops is huge because of IPAs.
And it keeps evolving. The focus shifts, maybe from sheer bitterness to those juicy IPA flavors now, and whatever new hops come next.
Precisely. The culture around it is always moving. New breweries gain cult followings for their IPAs. People chase the latest releases, review them meticulously. It's a very dynamic scene.
What a journey from, you know, casks on ships heading to India to this incredibly diverse, innovative global phenomenon we see today.
It really is remarkable. A practical export beer that became a symbol of empire, nearly vanished, and then got reborn as the absolute standard bearer for craft beer worldwide. Its roots are in colonial trade, sure, but its modern life is all about global creativity.
And all those different styles today, West Coast, Hazy Session, Black, they all still share that DNA going back to those 18th century British pale ales.
That's the lineage, and culturally, it just embodies that spirit of craft brewing, the focus on ingredients, especially hops, the pushing of boundaries, and the sheer enthusiasm of the drinkers. Economically, it's empowered small businesses and challenged the big players. There's a lot of myth mixed in with the history, but the true story is maybe even more interesting.
Definitely. Thinking about how radically it's changed just in the last few decades, it does make you wonder, doesn't it? What's the next big twist in the story for IPA? Something to mull over perhaps next time you have one.
Thanks for hanging out with us on this episode of The Beer Historian by Beergasmic.com. If you enjoyed the ride through beer history, do us a solid. Subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode.
You can find full show notes, links, and extra beery goodness over at beergasmic.com/podcast.
And hey, if you're feeling generous, drop us a 5-star review. It helps more beer lovers find the show, and it makes us feel all warm and fuzzy inside. Until next time, stay curious.
And stay hoppy.